Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up today, we'll be talking with our resident Vatican expert, Joan Lewis, about the past week's events here in the Vatican. But first, we go now to Jill Bevilacqua in her program, There's More to the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, where she reflects on this week's Gospel reading.
Jesus said, My sheep hear my voice. I know them and they follow me. I give them eternal life and they shall never perish. No one shall snatch them out of my hand. My Father is greater than all in what he has given me, and there is no snatching out of his hand. The Father and I are one.
All through the pages of the Old Testament runs the image of God as the shepherd of Israel. A homely image, familiar to the Israelites, who were an agricultural people. So when Jesus spoke of himself as shepherd and his followers as the sheep, he was not introducing a strange new idea, but developing one his listeners had grown up with. Today, with our emphasis on individualism, we tend to shun the pastoral image. Sheep, moreover, are not noted for initiative. But, as the Pope's preacher comments,
one of the most obvious phenomena in our society is the mass syndrome. We allow ourselves to be led passively by every sort of manipulation and hidden persuasion. Other people create models of well-being and behaviour, ideals and objectives of progress, and we follow them. We eat what we're advised to eat, dress as they teach us to. We speak as we hear, in slogans. The criterion by which the majority allows itself to be guided in its choices is the "that's the way everyone does it" of Mozart's Così fan tutte.
What Christ offers, he writes, is an experience of liberation. To belong to his flock is not to fall into the mass, but to be saved from it. Famous conversions come to mind, such as Newman's. When he became certain that he wanted to become a Catholic, he wrote to his friends that he intended to ask admission into the one fold of Christ. As for the experience of liberation, Thomas Merton wrote that once he realized he wanted to become a Catholic, everything inside me began to sing. My sheep hear my voice. I know them and they follow me. These words of our Lord reflect the lifestyle of the Holy Land Shepherd. He doesn't drive his flock, as our shepherds do, but walks in front of them, leading them to new pastures. And as he goes, writes H.V. Morton, he sometimes talks to them in a loud sing-song voice. And our traveller noticed something else, the sympathy that exists between the shepherd and his flock. And he offers an explanation.
One reason why the sheep and the shepherd are on such familiar terms in the Holy Land is that sheep are kept chiefly for wool and milk, and therefore live longer and exist together as a flock for a considerable time. Also, the shepherd spends his life with them. He's with them from their birth onwards, day and night, for even when they're driven into a cave or a sheepfold for the night, he never leaves them.
Since the Second Vatican Council introduced the three-year liturgical cycle, we have three different Gospels for what is known as Good Shepherd Sunday, all taken from chapter 10 of John. Year A covers the first 10 verses, where Jesus compares the true shepherd who enters the sheepfold through the gate with the thief who climbs in another way. And here already he speaks of the sheep hearing their shepherd's voice as he calls them one by one. They never follow a stranger. They do not recognize the voice of strangers. Jesus refers then to himself as the gate through which the sheep may go safely in and out. In year B, we're presented with the powerful image of Jesus as the good shepherd who lays down his life for his sheep, unlike the hireling who abandons them when a wolf appears. Here again, he refers to the rapport he has with his sheep, I know my own, and my own know me, just as the Father knows me, and I know the Father. In all three Gospels, the relationship between the sheep and the shepherd, and between Jesus and the Father, echo each other constantly. But whereas the first two follow directly on each other, our Gospel today comes a little later in the chapter. But before we return to it, let's listen to this extract from a letter written in the December of 1773 by the clergyman naturalist of Selborne, Gilbert White. In those leisurely days, a man of God had time to stand and stare and draw a biblical comparison.
One thing is very remarkable as to the sheep. From the westward till you get to the river Adour, all the flocks have horns and smooth white faces and white legs, and a hornless sheep is rarely to be seen. But as soon as you pass that river eastward and mount Beeding Hill, all the flocks at once become hornless, or as they call them, pole sheep. They have, moreover, black faces with a white tuft of wool on their foreheads and speckled and spotted legs, so that you would think that the flocks of Laban were pasturing on one side of the stream and the variegated breed of his son-in-law Jacob were cantoned along on the other. And this diversity holds good respectively on each side from the valley of Bramber and Beeding to the eastward and westward all the whole length of the downs. If you talk with the shepherds on this subject, they tell you that the case has been so from time immemorial, and smile at your simplicity if you ask them whether the situation of these two different breeds might not be reversed. However, an intelligent friend of mine near Chichester is determined to try the experiment, and has this autumn, at the hazard of being laughed at, introduced a parcel of black-faced hornless rams among his horned western ewes. The black-faced pole sheep have the shortest legs and the finest wool.
And now to our gospel, but first let John set the scene.
It was the time when the Feast of Dedication was being celebrated in Jerusalem. It was winter, and Jesus was in the temple, walking up and down in the portico of Solomon.
This portico, we're told, was what remained of the original temple building. It ran along the eastern side of the temple court, and its walls, which overhung the valley of Cedron, offered shelter in winter from the violent east winds. The Feast of Dedication, known also as Hanukkah, Feast of Lights, commemorated the re-consecration of the temple after its profanation by King Antiochus IV. And as Jesus walks in that sheltered spot, the Jews gather round him, with that attitude, notes Piero Bargellini, of mingled reverence and hostility, curiosity and diffidence. But they want to know something. There's this rumour that he is the Messiah. Could it possibly be? And so the more timid among them nudge the bolder ones to ask him straight out.
How much longer are you going to keep us in suspense? If you are the Christ, tell us plainly. Jesus replied, I have told you, but you do not believe. The works I do in my Father's name are my witness, but you do not believe, because you are no sheep of mine. The sheep that belong to me listen to my voice. I know them, and they follow me.
I give them eternal life, and they shall never perish, is the promise of our gospel. No one shall snatch them out of my hand. Or in another version, no one will ever steal them from me. In our technological age, the image of stealing a sheep doesn't have the force it would have had in Bible times, or even a mere 200 or 300 years ago. It was a serious offence to steal a sheep. As we know from the old saying, one might as well be hanged for a sheep as a lamb, for hanging was the penalty for sheep stealing. Wrote one N. Rogers in 1662.
Some desperate wretches, despairing of life, still act the more villainy, giving this desperate reason of it, as good be hanged for a great deal as for a little.
Back in the Middle Ages, one of the mystery plays, The Second Shepherd's Pageant, combined the serious story of the Nativity with a comic pseudo-nativity involving a stolen sheep. Borrowed from folklore, it recounts how Mac, the sheep stealer, hides a stolen sheep in a cradle, pretending his wife has just given birth. But the shepherds soon discover the trick, and Mac is tossed in a blanket while the sheep is returned to its owner. Probably no other psalm is so well known or so beloved as "The Lord is my shepherd." But let's hear how an old Palestinian shepherd explained it to a traveller in the Holy Land.
The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want.
Sheep somehow know that before they've been folded for the night, the shepherd has planned out their grazing for the morrow. It may be that he will take them back over the same ranges. It may be that he will go on to a new grazing ground. They don't worry. His guidance has been good in the past, and they have faith in the future, because they know he has their well-being in view.
Fresh and green are the pastures where he gives me repose.
Sheep graze from about 3:30 until 10 o'clock in the morning. They then lie down for 3 or 4 hours and rest. When they are contentedly chewing their cuds, the shepherd knows they are putting on fat. Consequently, the good shepherd starts his flock out on the rough herbage in the early hours, moving through the morning to the richer, sweeter grasses, finally coming to a shady place for the forenoon rest in fine green pastures. Sheep resting in such happy surroundings feel contentment.
Near restful waters he leads me to revive my drooping spirit.
Every shepherd knows that sheep will not drink gurgling water. There are many small springs high in the hills of the Holy Land whose waters run down the valleys only to evaporate in the desert sun. Although the sheep need the water, they will not drink from these fast-flowing streams. The shepherd must find a place where rocks or erosion have made a small pool, or else fashion with his hands a pocket sufficient to hold at least a bucketful.
He guides me along the right path. He is true to his name.
In the Holy Land, each sheep takes its place in the grazing line in the morning and keeps the same position throughout the day. Once during the day, however, each sheep leaves its place and goes to the shepherd. Whereupon the shepherd stretches out his hand and rubs the animal's nose and ears, scratches its chin, whispers affectionately into its ears. The sheep, meanwhile, rubs against his leg, or if the shepherd is sitting down, nibbles at his ear and rubs its cheek against his face. After a few minutes of this communion with its master, the sheep returns to its place in the feeding line.
If I should walk in the valley of darkness, no evil would I fear. You are there, with your crook and your staff. With these, you give me comfort.
There is an actual valley of the shadow of death in Palestine, and every shepherd from Spain to Dalmatia knows of it. It lies south of the Jericho Road, leading from Jerusalem to the Dead Sea. Just a narrow gorge through the mountains. It's 4.5 miles long, with the walls towering 1,500 feet above the floor of the valley, which is only 10 or 12 feet wide. Travel through the valley is dangerous, because the floor is broken by gullies, often 7 to 8 feet deep. Footing on solid rock is so narrow in places that a sheep cannot turn round. So it's an unwritten law of the shepherds that sheep must go up the valley in the morning hours and down towards the eventide, lest flocks should meet in the defile. About halfway through the valley, the pathway crosses from one side to the other, at a place where the path is cut in two by an 8-foot gully. One side of the gully is about 18 inches higher than the other. The sheep must jump across it. The shepherd stands at the break and coaxes or forces the sheep to make the leap. If one should slip or land in the gully, the shepherd's rod is brought into play. The old-style crook circles a sheep's neck or a small sheep's chest, and the animal is lifted to safety. If a more modern narrow crook is used, the sheep is caught about the hooves and lifted up to the walk. Many wild dogs lurk in the valley looking for prey. The shepherd, skilled in throwing his staff, uses it as a weapon. Thus, the sheep have learned to fear no evil, even in this valley of darkness, for their master is there to protect them from harm.
You have prepared a banquet for me in the sight of my foes.
David's meaning is a simple one when conditions on the Holy Land sheep ranges are known. Poisonous plants, which are fatal to grazing animals, abound there. Every spring, each shepherd must be constantly alert. When he finds such plants, he takes his mattock and goes on ahead of the flock, grubbing out every stick and root he can see. As he digs up the sticks, he lays them on little stone pyres, some of which were built by shepherds in Old Testament days, and by the next day they are dry enough to burn. Once the pasture is free from poisonous plants, the sheep are led into it, and in the presence of their plant enemies, they eat in peace.
My head you have anointed with oil, my cup is overflowing.
At every sheepfold there is a big earthen bowl of olive oil and a large jar of water. As the sheep come in for the night, they are led to a gate. The shepherd lays his rod across the top of the gate, just above the backs of his sheep. As each passes, he quickly examines it for briars in its ears, snags in the cheek, or weeping of the eyes, caused by dust or scratches. When any such conditions are found, the shepherd drops his rod across the sheep's back, and it steps out of line. Each sheep's wounds are carefully cleaned. Then the shepherd dips his hand into the olive oil and anoints the injury. A large cup is dipped into the jar of water, kept cool by evaporation in the unglazed pottery, and is brought out never half full, but overflowing. The sheep will sink its nose into the water, clear to the eyes, and drink until fully refreshed. When all are at rest, the shepherd replaces his staff within reach against night marauders, wraps himself in his woolen robe, and lies down across the gateway and settles for his night's repose. So, after all the care and protection the shepherd has given it, the sheep may well soliloquize in the twilight, much the same as David did in his psalm.
Surely goodness and kindness shall follow me all the days of my life. In the Lord's own house shall I dwell, forever and ever.
And now we go into studio with Joan Lewis, our resident Vatican expert, for a look over the past week's events here in the Vatican. So, Joan, thanks for coming in again today. This has been a very busy week, this last one. We've, of course, have seen celebrations for the 5th anniversary of Pope Benedict's election to
exactly.
the papacy. And so give us a rundown of what's been happening.
That anniversary celebration on Monday followed his weekend trip to Malta, mm-hmm. and we'll talk about that in a minute because he did at the Wednesday audience. And then, of course, the weekend trip to Malta followed Friday's, his 83rd birthday, the celebration of his birthday. And there was an American group. I don't think we said this on the last show. There was an American group, the Papal Foundation, that had an audience with the Pope the day of his birthday. They presented their annual gift to him and $6.2 million, as a matter of fact. And they also brought a cake to the Holy Father.
What does the Pope do with that money?
So that's always for the Pope's charities. So mm-hmm. it goes, for example, if the Holy Father wants to make a donation to Haiti to...
As he did for in the past.
Right, and we know he did for Holy Week for the seminary there. So... When there are huge disasters like that, or there may be many, many groups that we don't even know that much about that the Holy Father does and will make a contribution. So to go back to what we just were starting with, the fifth anniversary of Benedict's papacy, and of course you and I were both in Rome when he was elected. It's like, wow, was that 5 years ago?
I know. It seems like it was yesterday.
It seems like yesterday, and then in many other ways it almost even seems longer. So, of course, we know he was elected in the evening of April 19th. The conclave actually began just the day before, so this was a very short election. And then, of course, on the 24th, he celebrated his first Mass as pontiff. And, you know, I would say to our readers, if they ever want to read two amazing homilies given by this Holy Father, one would be on the day he became pope, April 24th. You want to know what his papacy is going to be about? He said that in his homily. And then the other one was the speech that he gave before the opening of the conclave, homily, to the cardinals, in which he more or less outlined the needs of the church. Brilliant, and you can really get into the heart and mind of this man. But anyway, we look at what the pope has done in those 5 years, his many trips. He's made 14 trips abroad, and that would also include, at this point, Malta. So it was a low-key ceremony in the Vatican. No, you know, fireworks in St. Peter's Square or anything. But and that's very much Benedict's personality, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I think more of the low-key and, oh, for heaven's sakes, don't celebrate me. He loves celebrations that have to do with saints or with Jesus Christ or with Mary or with the church. Mm-hmm. But, you know, don't celebrate me.
Well, the priesthood has been in the news quite a lot.
Sure.
In the Vatican these days,
in
particular in view of the upcoming end to the year for priests.
Doesn't it seem impossible? It seems like yesterday that was announced. I think that's the scary thing about the speed of lightning that life goes by. And we have Cardinal Hummels, who's prefect of the Congregation for the Clergy. He wrote a letter that was released this week. He wrote a letter to all the priests of the world extending an invitation from Pope Benedict to priests to come to Rome June 9th, 10th, and 11th. 11th, of course, will be the sacred feast of the Sacred Heart of Jesus, and that will mark the end of the year for priests. And the cardinal was wonderful in his letter. He did say that, albeit proportionately small in number, some priests have committed horrible and serious crimes of sexual abuse upon minors, deeds we condemn and rebuke in an absolute and uncompromising manner. However, he did very much stress, and I'd like to stress, on the other hand, he said, it's absolutely unacceptable to use the crimes of a few in order to sully the entire ecclesial body. And I'm telling you, if I could just interrupt for a minute, if I could walk on five continents and tell people something about this abuse scandal, it's, yes, condemn the abusers, but for heaven's sakes, don't forget the hundreds of thousands of good, wonderful, God-fearing priests who serve with total dedication. And that's basically really what the cardinal said in inviting priests to come to Rome. And of course, I wrote on my blog, I said, I'd love to think that every priest in the world would come to Rome and there'd be no room for the lay people in St. Peter's Square. But of course, then who would stay home and say Mass? Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can't. And there will be age, there will be infirmity, there will be cost involved. But I just hope it is a huge celebration in June of the priesthood.
Well, in fact, Pope Benedict at the audience on Wednesday, he ended his catechesis with a message to Rome's priests, didn't he?
He did. And his catechesis did. It was as it always is after a trip. A pope looks back at a trip that he's just returned from, talks about who he met, where he went, what he highlighted. And there's only one part of that I'll highlight in a minute. But you're right. At the audience, the Holy Father addressed priests from the Diocese of Rome. Of course, they're accompanied by the vicar, Cardinal Agostino Vallini. And they had returned from a pilgrimage to Ars, which is the home of the curé of Ars, St. John Mary Vianney, the model, of course, for the year for priests. And these priests from Rome were basically in the square that day to, as the Pope said himself, thanking them for their presence, a sign of affection and spiritual closeness. And the Pope said, I want to take this moment to express my respect and deep recognition to you and to priests all over the world who are dedicated to serving the people of God, bearing witness to Christ's charity. And important words, and we know the Holy Father is devastated by what has happened. and he's mentioned it a number of times recently, but I think the greatest sign of his personal devastation at the sex abuse scandal really came Sunday, and he talked about it Wednesday in the audience. It came Sunday in Malta when he did, in an unannounced manner, when he met with 8 of the, I think it was 10 victims who have spoken of being abused as children. The Holy Father told people, the general audience Wednesday, he said, following Mass in Malta at the granaries on Sunday, I met a number of victims of abuse by members of the clergy. I shared their suffering and greatly moved. I prayed with them, giving them assurances of the church's action. And what I found interesting about Sunday, and I'm sure our listeners were made aware of this, the accounts of the meeting that were given by some, I think it was 2 or so of the people, the young men who were there, said that the Pope had tears in his eyes as he met with them, speaking and told them of the shame and the horror of these acts. So anybody who doubts Pope Benedict's sincerity, I don't know where they're coming from myself. Mm-hmm. But
what else did he have to say about that Malta trip?
Well, you know, the Pope had a number of things that really kind of stuck out in that speech, one of which was his wonderful words to young people, and he urging them to be like St. Paul, to not be afraid of challenges and to not be afraid of setbacks in life, too. You have to face them head on and do it with a lot of faith. Those were beautiful words. But I think what most, after this or along with this, stuck out in my mind, the Pope talked about how for 2,000 years since the arrival of St. Paul, 1950 years ago, actually, he said a fervent and solid Christian community was born, which 2,000 years later is still faithful to the gospel, seeking to associate it with the complex questions of the modern age. And the Pope said this is not always easy or automatic, but the Maltese people find answers to challenges in the Christian view of life. And then he said, one sign of this, for example, is the fact that they have maintained a profound respect for unborn life and for the sacredness of marriage, choosing not to introduce abortion or divorce in the country's legal system. And that was one of the things that most struck me on my first ever visit to Malta quite a number of years ago, was the huge faith of these people. And it's something that there's over 400,000 Maltese, and if I'm not mistaken, it's like 98% are Catholic and like 97.8% are practicing Catholics.
Just before we close, we have time to speak about one other event that has happened here in the Vatican. Of course, we saw the passing of Cardinal Thomas Spidlick and the funeral mass for him here in St. Peter's Basilica.
Yes, he died at the age of 90 on last Friday, and the Pope, obviously because of his trip and everything else, he could not celebrate the funeral mass really until Tuesday. Cardinal Spidlick was a Czech Jesuit scholar, and he was a theologian who specialized in the study of the Eastern Christian traditions. Interestingly enough, he received his cardinal's hat, his red hat, from Pope John Paul in the consistory of 2003. So he was already over 80, but he could not participate in the 2005 papal conclave, but he did get the red hat in recognition of his scholarly work. And what I love what the Pope said about him, he said that the harsh trials that were part of Father Thomas Spidlick's life, he said he underwent so many harsh trials without losing his trust in God. And he linked him to Pope John Paul because he mentioned that both men retained a sense of humor, which Pope Benedict called a sign of intelligence, but also inner freedom. I really enjoyed that description. And the Pope said, in this context, there was an evident resemblance between the late cardinal and the venerable John Paul II. Both were wont to make jokes, though having suffered difficult and in some way similar personal circumstances in their youth. We don't have to set humor and joy to the side. They should be intimately linked to who we are as Christians. And that really was what the Pope was saying here.
Well, on that note, I think we'll have to close it, but that's a very uplifting, happy note to end on. So thank you so much, Joan, for being with us again this week.
See you next week.
Okay, bye-bye.
Rome Bureau Chief for EWTN, Joan Lewis there. And I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for listening. Laudator Jesus Christus.